This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is July 1st, 2021, and this is episode 246.
I'm Scott Lundebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, is Canada Day cancelled? No, but we'll get into it after we do a roundup of the latest news. Thank you first to the 103 people who contribute to the podcast every month. You can join them, help us grow at patreon.com/politicos. Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. I want to lead off with quick takes tonight just so we can leave time at the end to go through all the random thoughts about this day. But I think the way to start is with the really, it's a lot of heavy news today. There's the 182 unmarked graves identified by the Tunaha band at the former St. Eugene's Mission School outside Cranbrook. It feels like every few days, every week or two, we're going to get another discovery as we're finally exploring all of the residential schools. And so I don't think we have anything to add additionally beyond what was said about the previous discoveries, but just that we're going to keep finding these graves and it's going to keep hitting us.
Yes, I don't really have anything to add to that rather somber note.
The other somber note is that Lytton is gone. I don't know how to put it another way.
This comes just days after record-setting heat waves across BC were Lytton for, 3 days straight, broke one record after another for the hottest temperature recorded in Canada.
Yeah, wildfires broke out. It's unclear how. I saw some speculation on Twitter about whether or not it was related to CN rail train sparking. The point being, it was tinder dry, record-breaking hot. Literally, looking at the ground could probably start a fire at that point. It was dry and so hot that the fire raced through town. They had minutes to escape, and most people did, but I think a couple people did die. And as far as the pictures are showing on Twitter and elsewhere, it's horrific. And
the estimate I saw said 90% of buildings were destroyed.
Yeah. And that's not even counting, I think, many of the smaller settlements, homes, people who lived outside Lytton, and a lot of Indigenous people, especially around there. So really rough news there. I don't quite know how to address that other than to say it's awful and terrible, and our thoughts are with everyone displaced and suffering and hurting right now. Which brings us to Premier John Horgan's awful comments from a couple days ago. These were not, to be fair, in response to the fire in Lytton, but in response to the record-breaking heat wave, where here in Coquitlam, I saw temperatures hit 43 Celsius, which I think is the hottest I've ever felt in my life outside like a sauna or being in an actual desert.
Yeah, it was unpleasant on Monday. When I was outside too long, my sunglasses would heat up in the sun and start to hurt to wear. It was not a fun day. I was thankful to be working inside where there was air conditioning that did not keep up with demand, but at least kept it significantly cooler. But a lot of people did not have that benefit.
Yeah, I'm super privileged. I have a brand new heat pump system that kept our new home quite cool. We haven't figured out all the vents yet. Workstation in the basement was actually cooler than the main area where the thermostat was set at 24. So I think I was maybe sitting at like 19, 20 degrees, almost cold during all of this. And I could go outside and experience the heat, but then come in. So very different experience for me compared to, say, people in downtown Eastside or seniors or many people who did not have the ability to keep a good temperature.
Yeah, there's a lot of buildings here that do not have AC. My work did, but my home doesn't, and it got pretty hot here, and I'm lucky I could always just have a cold shower to fairly young and healthy, and was uncomfortable, but that was about the worst of it. But a lot of people were not so lucky, and we saw a significant spike in excess mortality over the last couple days here in BC. The numbers I saw suggested we were roughly double the number of typical deaths in kind of the four-day period. I think it was around 400 to 450 reported. About half of those you would expect just as a base rate.
Yeah, record-breaking ambulance calls and that kind of stuff for the day, or at least significantly above average. And I think it'll be a little bit before we get the response in, or before we get the data in to confirm how many people did die from heat stroke in this. But this does prompt questions about, we knew this was coming, and what precautions were put in place? This is a question a reporter put to John Horgan at his press conference on, I think it was Tuesday, when he was talking about the lifting of restrictions that we'll get into in a bit. His answer was bad, just like straight bad.
Yeah, it was like you said, bad. So the actual quote was that fatalities are a part of life.
Yeah, so he's quoting Dr. Henry. He says, I'll await the coroner's determination, but as Dr. Henry said, fatalities are part of life, and the consequences of, or the causes of those fatalities are examined by officials, blah, blah, blah. And he goes on to once again refer to people's personal responsibility in these situations and needing to just deal with it yourself kind of thing. He goes on to say, to talk about one of the advantages of COVID was to invest in air conditioning and HVAC for public schools.
Which is just a terrible way of saying we made overdue investments. And there really should not be an advantage to a pandemic, especially when it's to do the thing you should have done already.
Yeah. He walked the comments back on a Twitter statement
the next day. Like, there wasn't so much an apology in there, but he tried to soften them a bit.
Yeah, I think he expressed regret. He didn't say sorry. He meant, I don't think it was quite a non-apology, but it was definitely just someone take his shovel away. And this isn't the first time Horgan's put his foot in his mouth, and it's frustrating and embarrassing. And you can tell there's people around him who are smarter and better at these kind of comms and can handle it. But for some reason, he can't. And most of the time, he will listen to other people in the room, but he gets on a roll when he's on in front of a mic, and wow.
Yeah, so to be realistic about this, there was no way that the premier was going to be able to keep all 5 million British Columbians from suffering through the heat wave. There are limits to what even the most effective and well-aligned, altruistic, whatever you want to call it, organization can be. In this, and I don't doubt if you were to, say, peek under the hood of, I don't know, the ambulance service, the cooling centers, you'd probably find spots that could be improved. But just as a practical matter, there is a limit in how much can be done on this from the top levels. And that does mean that people do need to take some action on their own part to keep as cool as possible and as safe as possible during these times. So he's not wrong to say that there's that fatalities are part of life and that there's an element of personal responsibility, but he's an asshole for saying that, and particularly in such a callous way that does not express sorrow for the loss of people's loved ones or a recognition that there may have been room for improvement or just basic empathy in any of this.
Even just if the province did do anything, maybe highlight that. And if they didn't, like, I'm not as defeatist. It's bullshit to say he couldn't have done anything. Cities have public spaces. The province has public spaces that are air conditioned.
And there were some open in Vancouver.
Open them. Right? And yeah, locally here in Coquitlam, I know across Metro Vancouver, a lot of cities did open those as cooling shelters. We can act. We showed in the pandemic, we can act with urgency. We were still in a state of emergency at the time. A little bit more push could have been done because we've never seen that temperature before and we knew it was going to be hard. Like, it took activists in the downtown east side, I think a day of the extreme heat before they managed to get half of Oppenheimer Park back open so that they could at least go sit under a tree, which still isn't that pleasant in 40 degree weather, but at least it's not in the on the concrete in the alley with the heat and sun blazing down on you. So people did get some things done, and there was more room for the government to act. And just, oh, people died. Have empathy.
Yeah, it's bad. And for the most part, I think Corden's, for lack of a better term, normie suburban dad affect is a huge asset to the NDP. And honestly, just Horgan being up there is probably the easiest way to defuse any charge that the NDP are a bunch of radicals out of touch with British Columbians. Because whatever that energy is, he gives off the exact opposite of it. But occasionally it does backfire when he's shooting from the hip a little too much.
Let's talk about the other man who might want to be premier today. Aaron Gunn. I don't know how to describe him.
Soft
personality.
Yeah, he soft launched his campaign.
Yeah. He launched an official exploratory committee to seek the leadership of the BC Liberal Party, and he did so at a uncancel Canada Day barbecue, where he railed against the socialist mayor in Victoria who tore down a John A. Macdonald statue, and about all of the political extremists who would make us ashamed of this country. So he's going full culture war, which is not surprising.
Yeah, that really is his bread and butter. Like, I watched the video, he delivers the speech, and you sand some of the edges off that, and it's probably not too far off where a lot of people are if you were to ask them, and we'll get into that towards the end of the pod a bit more. But I also don't think that going full culture war is really going to be the thing that motivates a lot of votes. It may be a differentiator a bit, but come the end of the day, even if he manages to pull off the leadership win, which is far from certain doing a campaign based around that, in a general election, I just don't think that's going to play particularly well.
I agree on the latter. My wonder is about what the status of the BC Liberal Party membership is right now. I suspect it's atrophied. I suspect it's small and not as big as it once was under, say, like the Christy Clark leadership race and even the early years of her leadership or the Gordon Campbell years. And so if you are starting from a small base and you come in with an insurgent, radicalizing or exciting campaign like Aaron Gunn is pitching, where you can agitate up a motivated base, you can win a party. You could take over the party.
Well, keep in mind, it is a ranked choice system. So if you become very polarizing on this, you may do well in the first round or two, but by the time the subsequent votes get redistributed, it may not be good to have that position. It may be hard to win second and third choice votes, because if you're the kind of candidate that sets the tone or that everybody has to balance themselves off against, you either get a bunch of first round votes and get close enough that a few second rounds can put you over the top, or everyone's decided they're not voting for you anyway, so you're going to not get many of those second and third round choices.
The question is, does he come out more like Max Bernier, where he almost or potentially could win it by just sweeping up just enough and building that exact right kind of momentum? Or is he more like Derek Sloan, where he has some initial momentum, but then is nowhere near high enough to clinch it? I don't know yet.
It's hard to say. And like, yeah.
I could say a lot more about him, but we can come back to that much later.
I have a feeling we'll be talking about him for quite a few more months. So yeah, we can maybe table that for now.
The other big news out of today, or happening today specifically, is that we're in stage three of reopening two, reopen harder. COVID restrictions are almost gone.
No, we're now in stage three. So this would be reopen with a vengeance.
Right. No. It's reopen two.
Oh,
stage
okay,
three. Right. It's hard to keep up. It may be reopen three. I lost track. The point being, indoor gatherings can now happen up to 50 people or 50% of the capacity of the venue. Outdoor events can go to 5,000 people or 50% of the capacity, whichever is greater. And masks are now just recommended unless you have been fully vaccinated, i.e. received both vaccines and ideally waited 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm scheduled to get my second one 2 days from now, so I'm pretty excited for that. Still wear the mask for the 2 weeks and inside till we hit stage four. But yeah, it is nice that there's light at the end of the tunnel on this one. I was on transit for the first time in quite a few months, actually, earlier today. And anecdotally, everyone still seems to be masking up, which I think is probably a good sign.
I saw in some of the local Facebook groups that I'm in now, anecdotal reports of this grocery store is no longer enforcing mask mandates and so on and so forth. I haven't been outside enough or out of my house in indoor settings to know how strict people are following the mask requirements. I've seen a lot of the people on my Facebook feed tend to be very, why didn't we bring the mask mandate in sooner crowd, and are very skeptical of using it now. And I'm wondering, I'm with where the restrictions are going, given the cases, given what we're at and where we're at with vaccinations. I get we still face risks with the Delta variant and with other possible variants, but until those start to churn the tide, which obviously we've missed before, but we can't just have restrictions forever.
Yeah, there does need to be a lifting of them, both because they are not sustainable long term. And as I was like a basic social contract argument here, that in exchange for everybody going out and getting vaccinated, there was the promise of a more normal life that could come after. So, like, for all of those reasons and the fact that, yeah, the case counts are way down, this is all good and necessary. But it's also weird being around other people in any number more than five when you absolutely have to be.
Oh, yeah. Our brains are very rewired to not do a lot of things we used to do, so it'll take a while. Maybe we don't go back to exactly normal, and maybe we keep some level of public hygiene that will keep flu season from ever coming back. That would be nice.
Yeah, agreed. And one of the other changes here is that the WorkSafe COVID rules are now going away and being replaced with a general communicable diseases workplace guideline, which I still think some details on the implementation to be figured out, and it's still relying on the public health officer to direct on when there's something going around. But there is the chance that sort of thing could start to affect kind of workplace cultures around coming into work when you're contagious with stuff. So that might be a positive change to emerge out of this.
And I guess the other last bit of COVID BC update is that the state of emergency is over and we're no longer going to be getting regular briefings from Dr. Henry. It's just like we'll still get the daily numbers by press release for a while. But yeah, the Dr. Henry and Adrian Dix show is finally come to an end for at least the time being.
The season ender is a little anticlimactic on that.
Yeah, and it does once again raise questions about transparency of government, which has been a continual thread throughout this. There is obviously a point when it's reasonable to stop, and they had gone down to fairly infrequent. I don't know what the right answer there is, but yeah, no more regular updates at least.
Well, somewhere else that isn't getting regular updates is Parliament's attempts to get access to materials related to the firing of two scientists from the National Microbiology Laboratory in Winnipeg. The Liberal government has taken the extraordinary step of suing the Speaker of the House over this, which is just nuts. But we talked about that last week. But what's come out this week is reported in the Globe and Mail by Robert Fife and Stephen Chase. It's turned up some information on actually what the background allegations of impropriety are here and what the RCMP are investigating in relation to the firing. So the investigation started back in July 2019, so it's going on 2 years now, related to the apparent transfer of intellectual property to China and the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Specifically, what the story suggests is that related to materials such as plasma DNA molecules that can be used to create vaccines or viruses, and that they were transferred without the authorization of the Public Health Agency of Canada.
I don't even know what to really add to this story. It's good for Chase and Fife to be reporting a bit more to give us a bit more of a sense of what is the meat here, what is the actual story about. On the one hand, it seems like a matter of kind of corporate espionage of these like two people, almost like on the small scale, but the like liberals' intransigence at answering basic questions about this has driven it to become a national story.
Yeah, like that's the thing that I'm most curious about this here is like, what is the thing that the liberals think is so damaging that they can't even let Parliament see it in a controlled manner? That is odd and concerning. Further down in the story, they do mention that the investigation has also expanded into how two scientists from the People's Liberation Army in China were granted access to the lab at one point. So maybe there's a little more here than just corporate espionage, and then maybe actual military espionage involved. But even so, like there's got to be something damning for Canada or the Canadian government in this, if they're being so intransigent.
Either that, or it's something that threatens the Canada-China relations in a way that the government would find uncomfortable. Like, this government is not eager to poke the bear. And I don't know what it is, but I don't know. Hopefully we find more here, because I'm just still confused. And the fact this is connected to the Wuhan Institute is just like incredibly inconvenient and awkward coincidence, given the location that COVID started, even though that this predates that, but we only learned about it after. It's just confusing and a mess. We also won't get to learn much more out of Parliament this summer, as the Senate rose this week. They sat for two extra days to get Bill C-30, the Budget Implementation Act, through, as well as they managed to pass Bill C-12, I think it is, the Net Zero Accountability Act, the one that says Canada will achieve net zero climate targets and requires reports to be tabled to prove it. Notably, two bills didn't get passed, Bills C-6 and C-10. C-6, the conversion therapy bill, and C-10, the CRTC mega reform act that many criticize as an assault on free speech. Others just say it's a cumbersome, ineffective bill that won't really reflect how the internet works. And the Liberals hope it will give some protection to Canadian creators on the internet. In any case, both of them are sitting at Senate committees and haven't been considered yet, and the Liberals are blaming Conservative senators for not allowing these bills to pass by giving unanimous consent to extend the Senate sittings through the summer. Or Liberal MPs could have learned how to pass legislation in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, blaming this on the Conservatives, like I get the raw political calculus on it, but it's not really their fault that the Liberal government is so terrible at legislative management that they always get them these critical bills at the very last minute. And if they'd given the Senate these bills back in May, none of this would be a problem.
Yeah, but then the Liberals couldn't hold the conversion therapy bill as a gun to the head of the Conservatives and said, show us exactly how bigoted some of your members are. And then they can campaign once again on the backs of the LGBTQ2S+ community, saying, you better vote for us or the bigots will win and you'll never get rights. And with us, you might maybe get them eventually. I don't like it. Maybe we could just not have an election and they could pass the bills that they're promising to pass this fall.
I think that's unlikely, seen as we hit yet another item in the election speculation train wagon. Whatever metaphor you want to go with, as Trudeau apparently shaved his beard this week. Yeah, The speculation is that things are going to go sooner rather than later.
As Mulcair taught us, you can't become prime minister while having a beard. Someone else who's probably not going to become prime minister, even if things go really well for her, is Annamie Paul, who...
But she doesn't have a beard.
She does not. She's still facing a lot of internal strife. There was initially a statement from her that, or someone, there was one statement out that the Noah Zatzman, the staffer, she would not have to be condemning him to keep her job. But then the Green Party president came out and said,
incident.
No, of course, the interim president, because the whole thing is always up in the air. Liana Cusmano denied that and said the ultimatum is still in place and needs her to denounce Zatzman before July 20th, which I'm just going to bet is not going to happen. If she wanted to do that, she would have done it by now.
Yeah. One of the roles of staffers is so you can throw them under the bus, or that there's someone to take the fall if need be, if things go awry. And when the staffer is very clearly the one at fault there, like there is no reason for a party leader to go down with the ship on this one, which makes the whole refusal to do that just weird.
And so he's out of the party. He's not working for the party. I've seen it reported he's not working for her anymore. Maybe they're still friends, and the party shouldn't tell people not to be friends with people. That probably goes a little too far. But maybe, say, people working for the party shouldn't campaign against sitting members of our caucus. Seems like a reasonable thing to say. Things get weird, though, as there was mention that she was trying to... There was this other element of the Green Party fiasco that came up this week, that the Green Party is apparently laying off half of their staff, it was leaked, which is not a good move, not a good strategy, I think, in the lead up to what's likely to be a snap election, but suggests a lot of internal struggles, either with fundraising or spending.
Yeah, so it's up to 15 staffers are apparently being laid off, and I was actually surprised the Green Party had the fiscal wherewithal or financial resources to staff 30 people and still have operational money left over and campaign funds.
Party, so things get weird here because CBC reports that the party brought in $677,000 in the last quarter, which ended in March, which compares to the $576,000 they raised for the same quarter last year. So fundraising is arguably up under Paul, or at least in this spring. And so the question is, why can't they afford their staff? And I can see two reasons. One being there's just a lot of internal disarray, and maybe there is a coordinated effort to really just destabilize Paul. The other is bad spending decisions. I've heard it suggested Paul is taking a much higher salary than even Elizabeth May took from the party. Though I would have to caveat there that most of our politicians tend to be underpaid, and Elizabeth May does seem like the martyr type who would like significantly underpay herself.
Oh yeah, quite likely. I could see that.
And I
also that
don't
was...
think it's a great idea for anyone to come out and be like, hey, the one black woman leader should be paid less.
Yeah, and May's been drawing an MP salary for the past decade now. So I don't know what her pre-MP pay from the Green Party itself was, but that was 10 years ago. Inflation's low, but there's still some of it there. So like a little bit higher pay is just not unreasonable on its face anyway.
And one source who was telling CBC about these layoffs said during the meeting where they were announced that Paul was attempting to speak out against them, but that her microphone was muted, which is begging for more context. So, yeah, another bad week for the Green Party. I feel a little more sympathy for Paul this week than I have in previous weeks. But yeah, I don't see a good path for them in the next couple weeks, especially as they come up on this July 20th motion on non-confidence, which I think it requires 75% of the council, but the council is short a few bodies. So it'll be hard to remove her, but it'll look bad if a lot vote too.
Yeah, if more than half of the council votes too, like, yeah, it's not technically a passed vote, but effectively, like, that's a condemnation of leadership, if there ever was one. there's no way a party leader could hold on in good standing after that. So, like, the real, like, make or break number for her has got to be, like, no more than 10%, 20% at most.
Yeah, and, like, the council is different than the membership, and it could be that there are people with just grudges against her on there, but she needs to somehow paper those over, as frustrating as that probably has to be for her. That, or find a way to get them off the council and get your people in faster.
But that would not be doing politics differently.
Let's switch to the party that only does politics. The Liberal Party had a couple cabinet ministers in the news this week, and one's a leftover from last week, but they're still, it's still relevant, I think. First, let's talk about Catherine McKenna, infrastructure minister and former minister of the environment, announced her retirement this week, that she's not going to run in the next election.
Yeah, this one by surprise, because as recently as, I think, 6 months ago, she's indicated she was going to be running, generally seen as one of the more prominent ministers, in good standing, the party members, even potential leadership material after Trudeau finally leaves politics. And that all suddenly changed this past week when she announced she was stepping down. And perhaps most interestingly is the reason she gave to step down, which was that she wants to dedicate more time and effort on working on climate change, devote her professional energies to the fight against climate change, which begs the question, if the cabinet of the federal government in the infrastructure portfolio is not placed to do that, where else would there be? Or how much does that effectively discredit the current government's climate policies if someone with a highly relevant portfolio feels that not being in government is actually going to be more productive on that?
I think that's valid, but I do want to explore the idea that there's always multiple reasons people decide not to stay in politics or to leave politics, and there's the official one, but there's always going to be a lot weighing in the back. Catherine McKenna has been the subject of potentially the most sexist backlash of any Trudeau cabinet minister.
Oh, like, definitely of the Trudeau cabinet ministers.
Yeah. Like, she got called Climate Barbie. She's been harassed on Twitter. She's been screamed at by so many people for so long that undoubtedly she could do work on climate justice issues or on climate change issues in any other position, in any nonprofit or even a consulting firm or something like that, without the public profile that subjects her to that. And that is factoring into her mind. I have no judgment. I totally respect that you should not have to suffer that. It's unreasonable we expect that from our politicians.
Yeah, what was directed at her was gross and unacceptable. And I get why she would very much not want that to continue and be looking for a career where that isn't the case.
And she did get shuffled out of the climate file. And so even though infrastructure does tie into climate, it may not tie in as much as she wishes, or she wants maybe to be more engaged on the stuff she was working on. But because of the heat she attracted in climate, Trudeau couldn't keep her there. And so her hands are a bit tied more. So I'm willing to buy her argument at face value. Politics is not a great life, especially for women, people of color, and so many people in this country. So good luck to Catherine McKenna. But the interesting thing is she currently holds Ottawa Centre, which is a pretty strong Liberal stronghold, which begs the speculation of who's going to run in her seat. And that's where Mark Carney's name came back up almost instantly.
Oh, I think some of the initial reporting on her retirement had Mark Carney's name in the headline as well.
Former Bank of Canada governor, former Bank of the UK governor, guy who's been pretty much the only Bank of Canada governor most Canadians could name, I think. He's been building a public profile for himself as like a new progressive economist and bright shining star to take liberalism into the 21st century. And maybe this is his time to run for the Liberals and become the next finance minister / prime minister, if Chrystia Freeland doesn't have anything to say about it.
Well, I mean, she's been doing so many portfolios at this moment. I could see the case where, you know, being the deputy prime minister and one other significant portfolio is enough that it would not be seen as a demotion or anything for Carney to become finance minister. He's been widely rumored to be interested in running and made statements along those lines. Hasn't formally announced intention to seek that seat or any other one, but yeah, it's expected to be likely in this, either this election or the next.
I just get a lot of Michael Ignatieff flashbacks throughout this.
I think it is a little different, though. Ignatieff was out of the country for decades, I think, prior to his return for politics. Carney's been out since, what, he left Bank of Canada for Bank of England. You know, that's less than 10 years, I think, he was out of the country for. It's a little different.
Yeah, 2013.
I don't think the Bank of Canada, if you, like, ask Canadians, like, what are the, you know, national institutions you really respect, anyone would list that. But that's mostly because people don't think about the Bank of Canada. But, you know, it's a prestigious job. It's, you know, an important bit of public service. Like, the profiles are different enough. I'm not sure the comparison really holds. And, I don't know, the couple of interviews I've seen with him, he seems at least less wooden and uncharismatic. Now, I'm still not sure that you can necessarily translate success in central banking into political success, but I think he has a much better shot than Ignatieff does, or did. I don't know, maybe he just wants, like, maybe he won't even run for leader after Trudeau, just be successful finance minister.
Oh, the fait accompli. If he is in leadership, he will be helping the federal government to build the green economy, as they're advertising in all their press releases. The newest one is that by 2035 now, 100% of car and passenger trucks sold in this country will have to be zero emission vehicles. This accelerates from the previous target of 2040. And do you have in front of you what BC's target was in Clean BC?
Oh, it was, oh, it's either 2035 or 2040, around that time, I think.
2040.
Okay.
So this even accelerates beyond what Clean BC targeted as 2040. So thankfully, we will be moving to 100% of electric vehicle sales in the next, what is it now, 2021, 15 years, 14 years. Cool.
Yeah. Be nice to see, and hopefully we can hit that a little sooner for no other reason than get those obnoxiously loud motorcycles off the road.
No, they'll do what I've seen them do in some electric vehicles, which is to put noisemakers to simulate the sound of an electric, of a gas engine, just to give you that feel. And I guess they would need some shakers or something to make it really have that same feel as a motorbike.
Ugh, just the worst. I mean, motorbikes are fine if they were only quieter. The other day I was actually driving and I could not hear my podcast over the sound of the motorbike in the lane beside me, with the windows rolled up, mind you. Like, they are an absolute menace, like basic urban quality of life.
And here I'm the electric one living in the suburbs. But yeah, fewer gas guzzlers, very good thing. Credit where credit due, federal government. Let's get into the main discussion to close off the show, though. Let's talk about Canada Day. Let's talk about the politics, the perspectives on it, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and then we can bring our own views in at the end, which I'm sure we'll pepper through as well. How do you want to start this?
Let's actually situate it with the start with the TRC, the commission that actually looked into this and came up with a bunch of proposals on how to commemorate those tragically lost during the residential schools and other such dark chapters in our past.
Yeah, the TRC calls to action calls 79 to 83 of the 92 calls are around commemoration, as you're talking about. A few of these are done only recently. The National Day for Truth and Reconciliation was just proclaimed law, I believe, in the last couple of weeks. It will be in September, if I'm not mistaken.
September 30th.
Yeah, as a national holiday, and we'll see if provinces do the same. But that is a new statutory holiday to honor survivors, their families, and communities to ensure public commemoration of the history and legacy of residential schools remains a vital component of the reconciliation process. Call number 79 is, all of these are on the federal and or provincial governments and municipal governments. Call number 79 calls for the federal government to work with survivors and others to develop a reconciliation framework for Canadian heritage and commemoration, to do things like amend the Historic Sites and Monument Acts to include First Nations, Inuit, and Métis representation on the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada, something I didn't know exists, but I guess someone has to decide what is a historic site in this country, and that those would be the people, and Indigenous representation there sounds valuable. They would also recommend revising policies and practices of the National Program of Historical Commemoration. Again, another thing I wasn't aware exists, but encouraging that to integrate Indigenous history, heritage, and memory practices into Canada's national heritage, and start implementing a national heritage plan for commemorating residential schools and sites.
And then calls 81 and 82 are largely the same, just applying to the federal government and the provinces. And that would be to commission and install publicly accessible, highly visible residential schools, national or provincial monument, as the situation applies, in Ottawa and each provincial capital.
And finally, there's a call number 83 for the Canada Council of the Arts to establish a priority funding strategy for Indigenous and non-Indigenous artists to undertake collaborative projects to produce works that contribute to the reconciliation process. That one feels like it may actually be underway. I feel like Canada Council of the Arts has to have some Indigenous funding streams, but don't quote me.
Yeah,
it'd be quite the shame if they didn't have that yet. Jesus.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case, but arts funding is just something I am not familiar with the finer points on to definitively say, but it's almost certainly the case on that. On the federal monument, I believe they're in consultations at the moment on that. Don't know actually what the BC situation is with the residential schools monument in Victoria.
I know there isn't one built,
but...
If you're Googling that, I can say that the Canada Council for the Arts does have a Creating, Knowing, and Sharing Fund to promote the arts and cultures of First Nation, Inuit, and Métis people and to stimulate artistic practices in those communities. I don't know if that hits exactly what the TRC said, but it seems like a positive step towards promoting the memory. And given the...
Nothing comes up immediately on a Google, but for the interest of time and earth, and having a somewhat interesting podcast to listen to, go through all subsequent pages on Google.
Yeah, so John Horgan, do build that monument in Victoria. I know in Manitoba, they now have a couple new spaces where they could put that monument as a few statues came down today. But let's not dwell on statue debates. Let's talk about appropriate commemoration of the residential schools, genocide, tragedy, horrors, and what do we do with July 1st this year, given the raw hurt that I think many people are experiencing, both with the announcements from the number of residential schools that we're seeing. Oh, and I wasn't going to bring in Lytton, but it just feels like a different day.
Yeah, I'm not sure the Lytton's really super applicable there. Like, there's definitely a school of thought, and one I find somewhat compelling, that would say that in times of tragedy, it's important to hold on to those, the things that you know hold dear and find value in, and the country and the place you call home. That's one of those things that a lot of people value. And as tragic as that is, I could also see the case where maybe those individuals aren't necessarily going to be participating because they're currently dealing with the very immediate realities of being homeless, but wouldn't necessarily have any issues with the thing continuing on across Canada.
And so the challenge with celebrating Canada Day in the traditional fireworks pomp circumstance, Mounties and flag waving, is it does strike harder, and it is related to the residential schools issues. Like, I'm definitely in favor of making sure we have the specific recognitions outlined in the TRC, but those horrors happen because Canada. They happen because Canada exists, and the way Canada was built is built on the backs of those graves. And so I think it's that rawness that's really motivating a lot of people and a number of politicians to take a step back. And it varies from, like, the city of Victoria officially canceling Canada Day to, I think, just a lot of people taking a more somber tone this year. And I think that's what I take away as the overwhelming desire, is let's just tone it down a little this year, is the minimum you're seeing from a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's with COVID and everything, there's going to be less in-person events anyway, so it's also a little hard to disentangle that. Circling back to the TRC just briefly, like, I do think it is worth noting that nowhere in those recommendations was there a call to not hold Canada Day celebrations, and that should be kept in mind as we discuss them. But yeah, it's a little hard to judge the national mood. Like, everybody's being away and from each other, and there's just been less physical interaction, so it's hard to really get a good sense. I was able to find one poll on the matter, which I think is probably a better barometer than social media, which tends to be, particularly on Twitter, tends to be very unrepresentative of the broader Canadian public.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So this is a poll conducted by Leger on, I think it was June 28th.
It was released June 28th. It was conducted June 18th to 20th.
June 18th to 20th. Right. So they asked a bunch of questions, but specifically there was a question related to Canada Day, and they asked, do you feel, with all the questions about Canada and its historic record, would it be best to cancel Canada Day this year? Of that, 14% said yes. It was fairly uniform across regions, age groups, political affiliations, even for the most part. Like, the starkest difference was between the NDP and the Conservative Party, with the NDP at 27% and the Conservatives at 10%.
I want to meet the 10% of Conservatives who are eager to cancel Canada Day.
Oh.
Are they Wexit?
Yeah, I was just going to say, they're probably like angry people from the prairies who weren't super stoked about Canada Day even before the recent discoveries. Also, there's 5% in any poll will give you like weird answers. I think it gained a fair bit of notoriety in the social media space, but as far as where the general Canadian public is, they do not seem to support the notion of canceling Canada Day. And I think if you were to dig into it a little more, which the poll unfortunately doesn't do, I think you'd probably get an answer similar to what pretty much where most of the politicians have come out on this, which is, or at least the Liberals and Conservatives on it, and John Horgan too, actually, that the recent events are tragic. They're does need to be some degree of reflection, but overall, there's still a point to Canada Day that's worth carrying on with. And that you can set, there are good things about this country, and you can recognize the value this country has without being dismissive or ignoring the tragedy as well.
So this poll is fascinating. I think the should we cancel Canada Day is the least useful question out of there, because it doesn't define anything. It doesn't say what canceling Canada Day is. Is it like, oh, we're not going to have a stat holiday anymore? Because then I don't know anyone who'd be really on board with that, because no one wants to go to work if they don't have to. There are a number of other interesting questions in there. Like, they found that fewer than half of Canadians perceived Canada as one of the best countries in the world to live in. They found that fewer than half of Canadians plan to display a flag this year. Unfortunately, we don't have historical comparisons to tell whether those numbers have changed. But I do think it's striking that there is a sizable chunk in here that does seem to be less patriotic than I think a typical rah-rah Canada type poll would find. It does say that two-thirds think that our history is something to celebrate. It's a mixed attitude. I don't think you can find any Canadian who would, or anyone in the country would say there's nothing good in Canada's history.
Yeah. And on that, is Canada one of the best countries? Like 46% is it's one of the best. And then another 12 is okay, but comparable to many other countries in the world. So it, between those two, that does represent a pretty decent majority on that. And that would also include the, yeah, Canada's pretty good. We could be Sweden instead, would be captured in there. Like, that's hardly an anti-Canadian sentiment. Interestingly, also, they had a question on whether it would be good if the Canadian flag was displayed in more places and more often. 69% agreed with that. Interestingly, non-white Canadians were slightly higher on that answer.
That question was weird, because there was a follow-up of, do you think the Canadian flag will make marginalized people uncomfortable? And the overwhelming majority are like, no, because I haven't heard anyone really say they're offended by the flag. Even people who are like pretty anti, not anti-Canada, but like pretty skeptical of Canada's history aren't like, oh, I saw the flag and now I'm triggered. That
I feel like that's
it's pretty innocuous.
It's a sentiment I see, but only on Twitter. And like I said, that is in no way representative of Canada overall.
And so, like, for me, the discussion is really just around, like, this Canada Day should not be like any other, both because of COVID, but just the raw hurt many people are feeling. And I think it is worth saying that while the TRC didn't say you should cancel Canada Day, many Indigenous activists have said it this year in particular, not forever, but just as a matter of, let's recognize the hurt people have. And no one's saying you can't have beers. No one's saying you can't get drunk or wear red. But just like, maybe be a bit less obnoxious in public about the flag waving, because there is a really dark part of this country's history that has been denied for a long time, and actively denied in the way that Aaron Gunn's video we talked about does. He talks about John A. McDonnell as the like great statesman who built this country and built the railroads, but he doesn't talk about how the railroads were built with near slave labor, you know, underpaid Chinese laborers who were not granted citizenship. He didn't talk about the racism that this country was built on. There is a lot of stuff that it's not necessarily we need to atone for, but we need to acknowledge and rectify and just not repeat, and also deal with the ongoing, like, Canada's not a great country for many people to live in. It is great for me. It's great for you. And I think what we want is for it to be great for everyone. And that takes work.
Yeah, it's worth noting, too, that there were certainly activist calls, and it was not a unanimous position by Indigenous Canadians at all. And it's a complicated issue, and there are going to be mixed feelings everywhere on this. Canada certainly has its fair share of historic problems. It's also by no means perfect today. Do compare Canada to other countries around the world, and definitely compared to pretty much every society that existed before modern times. We're doing pretty good. There's still a lot of work to do on that. But we're definitely on the better end of a lot of these issues, and that's not to diminish where we've fallen short, but there is a lot of good about Canada and a lot to value in that. And to do the work on building the next phase, I think it is important to have a good foundation on it. And that does also come with a recognition of the good parts of Canada and the parts of Canada that bring value to a lot of people. And one day a year where we gather as a country, or virtually in some cases, to recognize those parts is a thing that should be done, because these are things that a huge amount of Canadians value, and that the inheritance that a lot of Canadians have in this is something that is worth noting, is worth honoring in a lot of ways, because the country that we have today, there's no guarantee it could have turned out this way. And there is something to the hard work that past generations to build it up to where it is now. And one day a year to come together and recognize that, and also recognize where we can go from here and how to take that inheritance and improve upon it and build it up and be able to pass it on to the generation that comes after us is a good thing. And there's a reason why most countries have a national day. You want to be able to have that day and be as a country doing the things that kind of instill a sense of civic identity, national identity. We're all in this together. We're all Canadians. Spirit to it. And it's, I think, important for governments to be an active player in that, which is why I wasn't particularly fond of the formally canceling events parts of it. And like, Canada's not a country that's naturally particularly cohesive. We're a country of regions that are often at each other's throats. There's no kind of the different regions have different identities. There's the long-standing difference between English Canadians and French Canadians. And like, there's a lot of pull factors in the country, a lot of things that just, if left to their own devices, would push the country apart a little bit more each year. And to be a successful country and continue the country forward, you do need some of those pull factors, those things that bring the country together. And some of that gets manifest in the civic holidays.
So I'm like pretty anti-traditionalist at the best of times, like borderline anarchist in some thinking on other times. And so ritualized large-scale events, I'm always going to be a little skeptical of. I don't like monarchy. I don't like harmless tradition for the sake of it, I'm fine with, but I think it's pretty clear that most countries have that national civic holiday, like you say, to build civic pride, but because nationalism is necessary to have a country from a government's point of view where you have a citizenry willing to go and fight for it. Russia has ways to build Russian pride. Canada has ways to build Canadian pride. So I'm, you know, going to hold some skepticism there, but we can set that aside because we could debate this all night, and I'm eager to wrap up. this country was built on blood. There's no way to deny it at this point. We can see it, and it's coming out every day or every week. We should talk about the good things, but we've spent a lot of time talking about the good things. Most of our education system is built around the good things. The Pierre Trudeau reforms to the Canadian, to build a Canadian identity, the multiculturalism, the flag, the anthem, the fact it's called Canada Day and not Dominion Day, all of this is myth-making, and it's worth interrogating. It's worth at least reflecting on it and being critical and turning your critical eye to it. You can still like Canada. I still do like Canada, but we need to acknowledge and be critical, is all I'm going to say.
On that building up of civic nationalism, like there absolutely is a need for it and can obviously go too far when it's done to excess, but you do need that kind of sense of teamwork, and you can't just build solidarity out of a transfer program. There does need to be a sense of something greater that people build into it. And humans are naturally tribal animals, and I think just as a practical matter for building a country, you're better off trying to use that and channel it in a beneficial way than trying to avoid it altogether on this. As for the bigger questions on reconciliation and everything, I feel it's unfortunate how much oxygen this one topic has sucked up, and you know, that's part of the reason I wanted to leave with the TRC calls, because there is a lot of things that I think there's pretty widespread agreement on in terms of taking action on, don't necessarily lead to the same level of disagreement that we've seen over this or the tearing down of statues or other things. And it's, I think, really unfortunate that a lot of more activist-y elements have channeled the conversation away from the things where there is widespread agreement and where we can reach unity on and actually advance reconciliation.
You get how Twitter and the media work, right?
Oh, yeah.
They go where controversy is. And so the loudest voice will always. This is why Aaron Gunn is going to do well. And it's going to make me so mad because he's just going to fuel it nonstop.
Yeah,
with white supremacists, like code words.
But it also went from a few random people on Twitter to a serious thing after the Victoria Council did their vote. So there's a bunch of elements at play here. But to get a little meta on this, like part of the reason why this gets so controversial is different people in different parts of the political spectrum have, I don't want to say different values, but have their most important values are sometimes calibrated a little differently. And there's a great book on this I'd recommend, The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, that really delves into it. And he's a political psychologist on this. And one of the things he talks about is how kind of moral intuitions and moral values get sacralized, and at which point it becomes very hard to talk people out of or rationally weigh trade-offs or any of that stuff on it. And I think it would be fairly uncontroversial to say that for large parts of the political spectrum, particularly on the left, anti-racism falls in that category. And the right's a little more complicated, but there are definitely that kind of loyalty to the group, national identity sorts of things that get somewhat sacralized or brought up to a level that is beyond just, yeah, it's a nice thing to generally like your country. And when those conflict, you're very unlikely to actually get a place where people can actually agree to compromise on it. Just gets very messy and toxic and unfortunate. And I think if we actually want to make progress on reconciliation, it would be much better to channel the energies to the areas where those kind of fundamental values conflicts don't exist on that. And just to be clear, I don't think the left doesn't value Canada or the right doesn't think that racism is bad on that, but it's the where you weight them in the overall scope of considerations on that. And going on quite a bit here, but ultimately I think we're better off if we take a constructive approach to this and actually really focus on building things up. And reconciliation is, by its very nature, has to be a constructive, not a destructive thing. And
though we do have to deconstruct the racism, like the Indian Act and specific colonial structures that are holding back, to be clear,
there are some specific reforms, but overall, no, like
we literally have to repeal the Indian Act.
Yeah, and
that's, we do need to build something first. There's another
10 hours talking about how that gets done. But for big picture, most of the work has to be constructive, not destructive. And I think it's somewhat unfortunate that recently we've seen more of the destructive aspects than the constructive ones.
Sometimes you got to tear things down to build something better. Let's close it off there. We've gone on quite a while. Happy July 1st or Canada Day, whatever you celebrate. You're all going to be listening to this on like July 3rd, so whatever. Good night.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.